I'm a grateful, enthusiastic, and very active member of the Al-Anon family groups. My name is Jack Carpenter. And I know I look like one, but I am not an alcoholic. I remember in the earliest days following her around, being drug around AA conferences as a guest, as an other. I had a special badge that said other. I was not one of you. And we both of us got this look on our face like we just bit into a lemon or something. And I could tell when I could read your mind. I have ESP. And I knew what y'all were thinking. And as we were going by, you were thinking, wow, what that poor woman must have gone through when that guy was drinking. It was my first resentment in recovery. I'm really thrilled to be here. This is really a privilege to come to Seaside. This is one of the places where, if you travel around the country and you have the privilege of being asked to speak, which I get asked to do frequently, the question I'll always ask the other speakers is, have you been to Seaside yet? And the reason I ask that is because look at this room. I go places in the country where there's 500 people for the AA speaker and they take a break, and 50 people come back to hear the Al-Anon speaker, and y'all don't do that up here. You guys clearly have a level of affection and commitment between the two fellowships that reflects the entire text of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, including the chapter Two Wives and the Family Afterwards. And I have to tell you that you do not encounter that every place that you go. And my hat's off to you. It's a treat to be here with these other speakers. I think I knew Carl for probably 10 years before we ever saw each other with clothes on. I'll let you ask Carl about that. I will defer that description. He just went, oh, yeah. Like you could forget this. Come on, Carl. And Georgia and I met a few years ago, and I told her last time I saw her, I was working in downtown L.A., and I work in a business where I've got these vehicles with people all over it, and we're all hooked by radio. And we weren't in Skid Row, but we were Skid Row adjacent, which is where she works. And she went by in her car, hanging out the window up to her waist, having an alcoholic seizure because she'd seen me driving down the road. And my crew's on the radio going, what the hell was that all about? And I said, it's because I bear a striking resemblance to Justin Bieber, apparently. Because I can't break her anonymity, or leaning out the window having an attack anonymity, so I just explained it away. And it's really a treat. And I have a rich history here with Harlan and with Terry. And, you know, these are people that I keep current with. And the life events have happened to me in recovery that stuff passed directly through the people that I met as a result of coming here. And one of the things that's been on my mind coming up here is that I don't remember how many years ago it was that we were here. Maybe it was in the early 2000s, 2000, 2001. My beautiful wife Leslie and I were here to talk. And one of the other speakers was Cliff Roach, who's been discussed already this weekend from the podium. And I remember absolutely sitting over at Duger's having dinner the first night that we were there hanging out with Cliff, who was my all-time, no offense to anybody else in the room, my all-time favorite AA speaker. I loved Cliff. Cliff, if you don't have his talk, please go see Terry. I'm sure he's got him out there. Cliff told the same story every time he stood at a podium, and I laughed every time. He was the funniest guy I ever saw at a podium, and he became a tremendous example for me and one of the first of many heroes that I collected. And Cliff passed away last week. I think it was Tuesday or Wednesday Cliff passed away. And it's a great loss to the rest of us. I stand before you a failed alcoholic. I was ashamed of that. I really was. Any closet drinkers here? Show of hands. Closet drinkers? I know you're out there. Come on. Don't be closet drinker now. I was closet sober. By the time I was in the United States Marine Corps, and we'll maybe get to a little bit more about that, by the time I was in the Marine Corps, it had already occurred to me that drinking didn't do for me what I saw it doing to the people around, that it was doing for the people around me. As a little kid, I'm watching my family growing up in a house with alcoholism in every direction. I'm the oldest of a whole bunch of kids. There was a lot of us before they finally figured out what was causing them, and I was the first one in the row. And I'm looking at what's the difference between us as the group of kids, and I don't want to be with them, I want to be with the adults. The difference was the activities they were doing, and mostly it was drinking. Drinking was a big component in my family and in my home, in everybody but my parents, which was confusing. And I'm a little kid, he asked me, my favorite number is 21. Because when I'm 21, you can no longer exclude me from the big kid table. I can do what they're doing, and I can experience the magical transformation that as a little kid I witnessed in the people around me, aunts, uncles, grandparents, later brothers and sisters and cousins, and eventually one of my own children. And I watched that, the spiritual experience provided by alcohol, and I couldn't wait to have that. And to my everlasting horror, I determined before I was old enough to take a legal drink that alcohol didn't do that for me. I was ashamed of the fact that I couldn't drink with them, I couldn't drug with them, I couldn't do the things that they did, and that I didn't have that, these enormous levels of courage, and I don't care what you think of me, that they achieved by consuming alcohol, that it never did for me. My wife, my beautiful wife Leslie, is here with me. Thank you for letting me bring her along. That's another reason that I really love coming up this way. We were having a conversation about it, and I said to her, the reason I never drank is because I need to be in control. I grew up in a place where I really believed, and with good reason, that my life was on the line, that I had to be in a constant state of vigilance, always on threat assessment. I needed to know where it was coming and what it was in order to not die in the place where I was. And violence and gunplay and stuff like that was a regular feature of my house. And when I drank alcohol, I lost control. I can't afford to be without control in that circumstance. And what my beautiful wife Leslie said to me was, what you never understood about beverage alcohol is when I drank alcohol, it gave me control. Exactly opposite effects to the introduction of the same chemical. As a result of that, I say this, but it's true, I don't have any idea where I'm going when I get up here, because it's really God's business. I didn't come up with a preconceived notion about what we're going to talk about. But I had a conversation with Gordy, who's our speaker tomorrow. We have an awful lot in common. If you have a cookie-cutter view of what Al-Anon looks like, and it's not completely dispelled by the time I get done talking up here, come and hear Gordy tomorrow. I think that he'll finish the job for you, that there is no cookie-cutter version of this. And I have vivid memories of being in the Marine Corps in 1972. Vietnam is still raging. We thought we were going straight into combat while we were in boot camp. And drugs and alcohol, mostly drugs, because we were a new generation. We were going to kill ourselves differently than our parents were killing themselves. We found a whole new way to kill ourselves. And they didn't have ways to test for it. And the way that I gathered value, the way that I was okay to breathe your air and walk your planet and deserve to be among you, was that I could fix it for you. And I remember guys that would have a bad acid trip, and we would catch them and tie them to their bunk and hide them from the OD and keep everything under. They couldn't test them the next day. They didn't have any facilities to do that. And my job was leading the brigade to capture a naked guy who's taken a four-way hit of window pane, you know, which when they say, did you eat that whole thing, I know how my evening's going to go right after that. Chasing him naked across the parade ground to capture him and tie him to a rack, and him showing an unusual ability to get free from the bonds, butt naked, and run across the top of the cubicle dividers for about 75 feet that wouldn't hold you if you leaned on it, and he would get like four stalls down before we'd catch him and hide him and then have to pretend there was no noise when the fire watch came looking to see what the commotion was. And what this did for me is it gave me value. If I look in here, there was nothing in here. If you look in here, I know that you'll reject me. I have this business model that says, I'm not enough. If you think I'm enough, I'm okay. If I fix it for you, I'm okay. If you think I'm a hero, I'm okay. If you think I'm all right, I'm all right. It's a great business model until the day that they don't think that you've done enough, paid enough, or sacrificed enough. And then we're back to square one. And, confronted with the idea that somebody disliked me or judged me as being less than, I have exactly two options. One of them is to change your mind, which I would energetically pursue. The outcome of that is highly unlikely, but it didn't stop me from doing it over and over and over again. And the other one was to devalue your opinion. Well, he cheats on his wife, and he cheats on, he's stealing from his expense account, and blah, 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 blah. I have to find a way to make your opinion not have merit in order for me to be okay, because there's nothing in here. And I describe self prior to working the steps as outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous as consisting of basically a little smoke cloud. And if you like me, I'm coming over there. And if you don't like me, I'm way over there. And I was talking to Gordy about it at dinner, that what happened as a direct result of working the steps is, and having a true understanding of who I am, what I've done, taking responsibility for that and cleaning it up with the help of a sponsor, I began to develop depth and weight. And something became true for me that they said to me early in Al-Anon that I had no ability whatsoever to understand, absolutely none. They said there would come a day when what somebody thinks of you would be none of your business. They might as well have been speaking Latin. I don't have any life experience or any logical, you know, function in my brain that explains how that could be remotely possible. Of course, what you think of me is of paramount importance, is how I live my entire life. And they said in Al-Anon, there come a day when what somebody thinks of you would be none of your business. And when I began to grasp that idea and began to apply the ideas and the actions contained in the steps and began to experience that in my life, first of all out there in the world, then in the workplace, and then you guys ratcheted it up, you upped the ante. You said, there'll come a day when what your wife thinks of you will be none of your business. There'll come a day when what your children think of you will be none of your business. And the end game, the end, telling you the end before the beginning, is that because of doing the work, because of really doing the steps as outlined in the book at the hands of a sponsor who was not an alcoholic, she put me to work in that book because that's what her sponsor did with her, I developed depth and weight to the point where somebody having a good or bad opinion of me has absolutely no power to push me anywhere in the room anymore. It has very little. If you think that I did a great job tonight and you slap me on the back, it's not going to move me from where I think I am. And if you're the little old lady who I've had come up to me and say, I really wish you'd have talked a lot more about recovery, that I'm still okay. I was talking to some of the speakers earlier, and I said, my old sponsor said, there's two ways to be of service from a microphone. You can be a quiet example or a loud warning. And both of them are equally effective. You're going to help somebody, even if you suck, so it's okay. What I do up here is not my business. And I'll tell you that when I first started doing this, and it was a long time ago, I suffered from, you know, I had a little problem with ego. Probably none of you had that little ego problem. And I would get invited somewhere to speak, and then I would lay awake for the full night after that, looking at the ceiling going, oh, you missed that story, and you went too long, you went too short, that joke didn't work on me. I remember an AA from the podium one time talk about, he described his alcoholism, and he made a gesture, and I'm a visual person. He said, my alcoholism was on me. And he put his hand over his face. And it was on me. And I did that a couple of times. And then I went to a couple of guys who are not around here anymore. The reason I'm standing here is those two guys. One of them was Scott Redmond, and the other one was Dr. Paul. And I basically said to them, you know, I understand that being asked to speak is a privilege, but this feeds a part of me that needs to be starved. And I'm not doing well with it. I think I need to stop talking and stop standing at podiums and stop sharing my story. Sponsor people, set up chairs, do the service commitments. I'm probably better at that anyway and of more value. And they were both kind enough to point out to me some things that were essentially, they were able to surgically remove my ego from anything I've ever done from a podium from that day till this. It's none of my business what I do. I'll have no idea what I say from up here unless I listen to the talk later. And it was a direct result of things like Scott taking me out on the end of a pier, and we were down in Mexico on a week-long vacation, and he sat with me for 3 hours, and we went over exactly what it is, what my role is here and how I fit with you. And that allowed me to begin to come and do this and not have to worry about what it is and to disengage my ego from it. And I guarantee you that I'm not up here out of any need or want or desire to stand at a microphone in front of you guys. I absolutely am up here always and only for a single purpose, and that's to repay a debt that is unpayable to people like Cliff and Dr. Paul and Scott Redmond and Bob B. from Minnesota. The guys, the people, the families, Cliff and Pat, who came and shared what family recovery looked like in the disease of alcoholism and created an example for my wife and I to follow in order to have recovery, sobriety, a successful marriage, to be successful parents, to be good members of our community. That was what I got from those people who did that, and I come up here only to pay that debt to those people. And as I say, most of the time I have to travel without my wife. Frankly, I'd rather be home with her. This time she gets to come with me. My sponsor has directed me that after I'm done here, we're going to spend some time together, and we're going to not be answering the phone for a couple of days and take care of a little business with ourselves. In that house that I grew up in, my parents were not alcoholic. That was a subject of some confusion for me, because I would come to meetings and I would hear you guys talking about what it was like to grow up in an alcoholic home, And I'm going, yep, that, the violence, yeah, police, they were there. There was jails. We had a lot of last names. I didn't move more than 5 miles from any particular house, and I probably went to 15 elementary schools. I probably had 4 or 5 different last names on a rotating basis. When they turn the power off, or the process servers are looking for somebody, or the police are looking for somebody, you just get a new last name. Now you got a new last name for a while, and we would just move on. That was what we did, and it was in a very confined area. And I identified with what you were talking about, but I couldn't label alcoholism on my parents. And I don't believe that my parents were alcoholic. What I know today is that both of my parents are deeply affected by alcoholism in their parents. That the violence, the secrets, the cliques, the alliances, my side against your side. I remember vividly Mom talking with her girlfriends about how she was going to catch Dad at whatever he was doing. And I remember Dad talking with his friends about how he's going to try and get away with stuff. And conflict resolution, we were taught skills early on. I remember an event where my dad went through a bunch of wives, and he cheated on all his wives with all of his other wives, past and present, didn't matter. And violence was going on. And my dad, my stepmom, got into a fight. And firearms were not unheard of in an altercation in the house. Usually it was Dad who got to the pistol first. He had a wonderful 1911 slide action 45, and he'd get to the gun first, and a lot of drama would happen. But on this particular night, Mom got to the gun first. They were in the kitchen screaming at each other, not making a lot of headway, and she went and got the pistol, and she walked in 5 feet away from him, pointed it straight at his chest, and pulled the trigger. Yeah. Gun didn't go off. Mom says, "This thing's broke." My dad says, "Let me see that." Clicked the safety off, shot around through the wall of the kitchen into the neighbor's house. We were really not popular with our neighbors anywhere we lived. And he said, "No, it seems to be working fine. Hand it back to Mom." Conflict resolution skills. And then they did what you did. They laughed. That could have gone either way, but they laughed. The part of the story that's not funny is where we were. We're the kids. We're in the other room of the house. We're doing something that'll sound familiar to people in this room. We were trying to figure out how to be invisible. Remember when Mom and Dad would fight, and they're clearly frustrated and unable to reach any kind of a resolution to whatever conflict was going on with each other? Woe be you if you draw the attention of the combatants. A noise, a chore not done, anything, behavior, anything whatsoever, to draw the laser beams of the combatants, your life could end. And we're practicing being invisible in the house, deeply affected by alcohol, without the chemical being present inside the walls. That's what my house looked like. I escaped. This is what escape looks for somebody like me. My old sponsor said to me one time, it was a riddle. You've got to be careful, them sponsors are sneaky. They go to a secret sponsor school or something. And he said, "Do you know why you have to go to Al-Anon?" And I said, "No, why do I have to go to Al-Anon?" And he said, "Because your solutions make your problems look good." My solution to growing up in that madhouse with the violence and the unpredictability and the fear levels I got going on and all the behaviors going on was at 16 years old to move out, to get 3 jobs. I moved in with my girlfriend and her late stage alcoholic mom, and I worked 3 jobs to pay the bills in that house. That's the solution that I come up with to living in a house that's affected by alcoholism. I've got no plans. I went out in the world and I did a lot of things that I'm not proud of. I got pregnant and I got married. Probably none of you did that. And I'm off in the Marine Corps, and I came out of the service, and my first year back, by now I have this new role in the family. You see, I'm the one that everybody comes to when there's a problem, somebody needs fixing, inventory needs taken, fight needs getting into or get out of. I'm the clearinghouse for information. I am 911 on everybody's phone in the family. We do not call 911 on the real phone, because you know what happens when you call 911? The police come. What a shock. And generally, they're looking for one or more members of the house. The police is not a viable option to fixing a problem. So I'm the guy that gets the call no matter what's going on. And I was my first year out of the service. I've got this role in the family now. I'm the central clearinghouse for information and inventory taken for anybody who needs an inventory taken. taken, they all call me. And if there's, if the crap hits the fan, I get the call. And I got that call in the middle of the night. And it's a story I've told here before, but it's 2:30 in the morning, and my phone rings, and it's the stepmom with the pistol. Remember the one with the pistol? She calls me up. She says, "Your brother's been at the bar. He's been in a fight. He's gone home. He dropped off his girlfriend, who is these eight guys had broken his van up and tried to rape her and drag him out the window. And he'd gone home, dropped her off, got the shotgun, went back to the bar." And mom says, "And you need to go get him." Well, of course I do. This is what I do. I jumped out of bed, jumped in my car. I knew the places that he drank. I went to the first watering hole, and I found him. He's right there. It was a pizza place about a mile from my house. He's in an empty parking lot in his van with no windows. There's glass everywhere. He's got the shotgun propped up on the wind wing of his old van, and he's waiting. And I pull up, got out of the car, and sauntered over there. My old sponsor says, "I have the unerring ability to ask ridiculous questions of the alcoholic." And I walked up and I said, "So what you doing?" And he said, "Well, I'm waiting for him to come back. It's looking like an easy night in the hero business." I said, "I'll be having the shotgun." He gave me the shotgun. I cracked the breech, pulled the shells out, dropped it in the trunk. Mission accomplished. I can breathe your air one more day. I'm heading home, and I said, "So what are you going to do?" He said, "Well, I'm going to find him." The bars close at 2 in California. I know they're pretty much probably sleeping it off someplace. He's not likely to find him. It's still going to be an easy night. And I said, "You go with God," and I got in my car to leave. Now, you have to understand about my family that it operated more like a gang than a family. And any proper gang has to have a proper communications network. There were no cell phones in those days, but we had CB radios. All our cars, all our trucks, everybody had CB radios. We got a network. And as I'm heading out into the street, he took off going that way around the shopping center. And as I'm almost in the street, my radio comes on, and he says, "I found them. They're around the back." I was that close to getting away, so I turned around. And he went that way, so I went this way. And we come around behind this place, and there's about 5 acres of asphalt. There's two driveways in from the street. As I pull into this one over here, I see brother down there. His headlights are in that driveway. There's eight guys around three cars in the middle of the parking lot, right in the center, under the light, drinking at 3 o'clock in the morning after the bar's closed beer. I'm in the other driveway. We got all 8 of them surrounded. Brother comes on the radio, and he says, "I'm going in." If you're new to Al-Anon, that means we're going in. Now, I'm a thinker and a planner, and unlike my brother, I've not been drinking any alcohol tonight, so I do not have any liquid courage in reserve to go in there and take into this brawl we're about to start, where my life, these guys clearly indicated a willingness to be violent to the point of well beyond getting a spanking, and I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do when brother's headlights get really bright. He just stood on the gas, and he's coming. Now I got a choice to make. What am I going to do? What plan am I going to come up with? The plan I came up with on the spur of the moment, my solutions are worse than my problems, is I stepped on the gas on my Mustang and I grabbed second gear and got up about 70 miles an hour and closing really fast on these guys. I mashed the emergency brake to the floor and brought the back end around sideways, and my plan was to slide in there sideways and hit one of those cars in the hopes of pinning 2 or 3 of them between the chassis to give me just a moment to clear the car. We had family values, you know. Daddy taught me early on. He said the most critical time in any fight when you got a car involved is that few seconds it takes to get in or out. You're really vulnerable, and my solution was to slide in there and take them guys down. I put that plan in motion. By now, I'm making an awful lot of noise and some smoke. I have the undivided attention of these 8 guys looking at me over their beers with eyes about that big. Well, my radio comes on one more time and says, "I don't think that's them." Yeah. Yep, that's right. I make my living doing things with a car that would horrify most of you, and I've been doing that for over 40 years, and I probably did the best driving I've ever done in my life that night not to kill somebody. I gathered that car up, got it going straight enough to get past them. If they'd had another coat of paint on the door, I'd have hooked them. And I went by them. I went right by baby brother. Wasn't really in the mood to chat with him right now. I loved him, but not too much that night. and I went home. But this is the important part of this story. This sounds like, don't I sound like a guy that if you're in the bar and they start breaking the tops off the beer bottles and it's fixing to get busy, you'd like to have somebody who's sick and crazy like me on your back, right? I sound like a guy who can muster amounts of courage when it's necessary. We're going in 2-8. I'd have killed somebody that night, and I had no qualms about it. I knew that it was going to be them or me. Certainly, somebody would have been maimed or killed in the process of that. The reason I went in there and didn't turn around and go away is because I'm afraid. Not because I'm brave. I'm afraid. I'm afraid of dying. I'm afraid of getting seriously hurt by these guys. I'm afraid of what's going to happen when I finally get out of the car. I'm afraid of what's going to happen when the police show up and start counting the bodies. I'm afraid. There's one thing I'm afraid of more than anything else. I'm afraid of what y'all think of me if I don't go in there. What's the family going to think if I turn around that driveway and go home and leave him to his fate with those 8 guys, a fate which he clearly earned by his behavior up until that point in the evening, by the way. What's the family going to think of me? And I went in there so afraid of what you might think of me that I was prepared to take somebody's life. I'm the most dangerous thing on the planet. I'm afraid enough to kill you so that you won't know I'm afraid. The other part of that story that's important is that when I got out of that bed at 2 o'clock in the morning, 2:30 in the morning, I had a wife and I had a couple of children. One of them had been involved in a drowning accident at the age of 1, and she was asleep by my side of the bed in a crib, hooked up to a myriad of medical electronic equipment in a profound coma, where she slept every night for a year before she died. Heart machines, breathing monitors, suction machines, which was... I still have nightmares about that, the sound of the suction machine and the piece of mucus that would come out of the trach tube, and she's strangling on her own body fluids and trying to clear that, and you're trying to catch it with that suction tube. What would happen to me is I would stand there, be with her, stand at the foot of her crib, listening to the heart machine and the breathing monitors and the suction thing and the snot coming in and out of her trach tube, and the emotions would start to come up. And they would go right to the base of my eyeballs where they might get away. And I got to go. I would flee my house. For the entire year that that child lay in a coma, in need of 24-hour-a-day constant care, I did virtually none of it because I couldn't do it. Now, I guarantee you that if a drink or a drug could have fixed that, I'd have been drunk then and I'd be drunk now. But it never provided that relief for me. You know, we hear an awful lot about people, you've heard this weekend, and you probably will some more, about folks that describe themselves basically the way I describe myself. And then on that day that they first time they injected alcohol in a sufficient quantity, it created something for them, a life that was suddenly livable, that they were okay, that they could dance, and they could be with people, and they had levels of bravery, and they suddenly belonged on the planet. And when I consumed alcohol, I never got that. If you're an alcoholic who's sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, what would you have done on the day that that happened to you if it hadn't worked? Because that's what happened to me. It's restless, irritable, discontent all the time and no relief and no tools to deal with what happens to me. That little girl went in the ground after a year. I went up there and I put her and God in the ground together and I put dirt on both of them. There's no God of mine who'd do that to a little kid. And frankly, by the time I got to you, I was first exposed to AA as a guest and then got to Al-Anon. I lived with the firm conviction that God had killed my child because I was a piece of crap. Now, I can't describe in any terms better than that the level of arrogance and ego that I brought to you, that God would stop his busy day and smite my child in order to send me an evil candygram about who I really am as a human being. But that's what I felt like. And somebody was talking about an angry atheist. I was not an atheist. I was not an agnostic. I was something, a term I learned around here, I was God antagonistic. Woe be you, you come to my front door with your magazines and your good news to share with me. Might be a really bad day for you. God antagonistic. I didn't come here with any desire or willingness whatsoever to have a God in my life. And for 15 years, 17 years after that child died, I never talked about it, and I never went up to the cemetery as if it never happened, because I lacked the tools to deal with what happens to me when it comes to my consciousness. because chemical intervention does not relieve that. I got no place to go, so it's as if it never happened. When I followed my beautiful wife, Leslie, into AA as a guest of Alcoholics Anonymous to learn about a disease that I do not have from the people that have it, I heard you all talking about God. I remember the first night home after a meeting, I was in the shower doing the 12 steps. I did my inventory over the shower door with her sitting doing her makeup out there, but I was trying to navigate through them like God was a road cone, and I'm whipping through the road cones trying to miss that part because I knew that there was something that that would offer, and I knew I could benefit from it, but I know that it can't deal with the level of guilt and shame I've got attached to that idea that I am not enough of a man to show up when my family needs me the most, to be a husband, a father, a partner, to take care of that child. The best I could do was work and make sure that we had food on the table. I had nothing else to bring to that. When that marriage ended, I would have told you with some conviction that the failure of that marriage was her fault, because my disease has a tendency to lie to me, just like the alcoholic's disease lies to the alcoholic. And my disease would tell me she doesn't love me enough or love me the right way, therefore I can go do the behaviors that my disease wants me to do, and it's not my fault. I remember talking with one of my brothers who has a significant drink habit about drinking, and he said to me, well, if you had problems like I have, you would drink like I do. And I'd been around you long enough not to say out loud the thought which first came to me, which was, if I drank like you, I know I would have problems like you. And I'm going to fast forward through a couple of things. I'm the guy, if you've heard the rumors, I'm the guy who, when I was out there in the world, I work in the movie business, I'm gone for 6 to 9 months a year, I'm gone all the time. I'm out behaving as if I'm single, I'm creating an awful lot of wreckage. I don't go back to that house, I can't be in that house or with those people because the thing happens to me, I've just got to go. And I met Leslie on a location in Arizona, and through a series of circumstances, she was on her way to California. She called me for a date. I got lost trying to find her. She came out to look for me and got in a wreck and died in the wreck. I came across a wreck. It was in a high desert above Los Angeles, and there was police and paramedics and fire department, the jaws of life, and they're trying to get this car open because she's in there not breathing. And I overhear the officer say, we don't know who she is. She has no identification, and she's got Nebraska plates. And anybody want to guess who it was? She's sitting right here in the front row. So they loaded her in an ambulance. They got her heart started, took us across. I remember following that ambulance. We're going to do that more than once. Following that ambulance, red lights and sirens across the desert to this little hospital, and they rolled her into a little room there, and we're waiting in the room for somebody to come see her, and she stops breathing again. I'm thinking, so far, this date sucks. I've had better dates. This one's not really measuring up. I run out in the hallway and I grab a nurse and tell her what's going on, and they call a code, and these blue lights over all the doors start flashing, and on the PA they're going, code blue, room 7, code blue. And it happened so fast they didn't have time to get me out of the room. They came through the door with a crash cart, little tiny room about as big as this table squared, and shoved me in the corner and went to work on getting her heart started. And I was at a front row seat to it because they just didn't have time to get rid of me. And they got her heart going. I remember her rolling her head over on the gurney and looking at me with those big, pretty eyes she's got and saying, let me go. Let me go. And I have no understanding. My wife's first sponsor said to me once, something wishes to become prophetic, and I believe it absolutely. She said, you are not an alcoholic, and you will never know what an alcoholic knows. And I believe that today. I've been to 3,000 Alcoholics Anonymous meetings as a guest of Alcoholics Anonymous to learn compassion for the people that suffer clearly from a disease of alcoholism. But on that day when she said, let me go, I know now what I saw was just a moment of how bad it is to understand that she'd done it again and that she was going to pay the price for doing it again. They're probably waiting to arrest her in the lobby of the hospital, and that dying looked better than living. And when they got her heart started, she came back unwillingly. And when she opened her eyes, I was there. And she was not happy to see me. They threw her out of the hospital. Private hospital, no insurance. She's got to go. They were nice enough to put a neck brace on her, loaded her in my car, wheeled her out to the car, loaded her up. The nurse says, I hope you live near a hospital. She's really not doing very well. I said, oh, thanks for sharing. Now, we didn't know where she was living. She was some phantom uncle. I've still not met this guy. We still debate his very existence. Might have been one of her imaginary friends. And we're debating what to do with my date. Doesn't know where she lives, and I don't know where to take her. And she whispers, because she took the steering wheel with the throat. She got broken bones and everything. And she says, "You can take me to a hotel." And I literally thought about that for about 8 seconds. I remember her hand was on the seat between us. She couldn't lift it off the seat. She was absolutely, completely destroyed in this wreck. Put my hand on top of hers, and I says, "Okay, honey, I got a better idea. I'll just take you home." Did y'all want to think about that for a minute, or did you forget I got a wife and a family at home? I am not the AA speaker. That's at 7:30. I did this stone cold sober. Apparently, my solutions make my problems look good. So I went to a phone booth to call home. Phone booth was this funny glass box, a door you pushed in to go in. Google was about a 9-inch thick book hanging on a chain. I called that wife and told her a story, which I'd gotten pretty good at by that time. Said a friend of mine's been in a wreck and bringing her home. She met us in the driveway. She grabbed Leslie's ankles. I got her armpits, and we carried her in. Now, Leslie will tell you, if you have the privilege of hearing her talk, that as we're coming through the door, I dropped her. She thought she was going to die right there. I have absolutely no memory of that. I might have been a little nervous bringing the girlfriend home to meet the wife and kids for the first time. We put her in bed, and we set up shifts to watch her around the clock, because she might burst into flames at any minute. After about 3 days, it became apparent that she wasn't going to die on us right away, and we got her into the back door of this little medical clinic down the street, and they started setting her bones. And it set up 6 months of some really interesting living, where my wife and my girlfriend are becoming friends. My wife is confiding in my girlfriend. She thinks there may be some problems in our marriage. My girlfriend, who now likes my wife, is giving her little helpful hints on how to spice up the relationship. I'm trying to get my girlfriend to mind her own business. But it's not unmanageable yet. My sponsor said I'm not allowed to say anymore what I used to say, which was, I had a lot of balls in the air. I don't do that anymore. Only the sick ones laugh at that. Leslie got well enough to get a job offer. She was on the move. Alcoholism took her places, and she got a job offer in Texas, and we got her medical treatment, got her a car, and sent her off to Texas. And I set about dissolving a marriage that I frankly had not showed up for a long time. And as I told you, I would have placed the blame for the failure of that marriage squarely on that woman. But the reality is, because of an inventory, what I understand is that I did not show up in that marriage in any way, shape, or form. I didn't show up as a husband, as a partner, as a friend. I showed up financially, which was that thing I was lacking as a kid, so it's the only thing that's important to me to bring now. And when I would show up for sex and she didn't want to sleep with me, I made that her fault, and I wouldn't have wanted to sleep with me either. Those are the things, those are the realities and the facts of my life exposed by a rigorous inventory. Leslie got in trouble in Texas and called me up and asked if she could come back to California, and I drove straight down and got her and brought her back. Spent the last year of her active drinking with her under my roof. And when I told you that I was closet sober, I will tell you that after 2 years of living with me and 6 months into her sobriety, it dawned on her for the first time that I didn't drink. She could not believe anybody be as crazy as I was and not be drinking too, and she just didn't notice until 6 months of sober. She said, "Oh my God, he doesn't drink," which might have explained some of my behavior. She, a year and a half in, it's just a madhouse. I don't know what's going on. My wife is a floor drinker. That's the nature of her alcoholism. When I'm gone on the road, which is a significant amount of time, she's a floor drinker. She drinks, as she starts to get to that point where consciousness is starting to be fleeting or she's getting ready to black out, she retires to the bathroom. She does the rest of her drinking on the bathroom floor so that when she wakes up, it's everything she needs right there. She says, the floor is cool. It's a quick trip to any place you got to get to, especially if you're in a hurry. All the basic needs are met there. But I can't know that she's drinking like that. So I would come home, the conquering hero, home from a big job, ready to see my girl, and I'd come through the door to the dragon. I never knew what was on the other side. I 12-stepped a guy one time, and he described coming home from the road driving truck long haul, and he said, I'd come home and I put my hand, he knew nothing about us. He said, I put my hand on the doorknob, and then I would pause. And I would try and guess which wife was inside, because he never really knew. My presence in the house represented an impediment to her drinking the way that she wanted to drink, and my being there made her unhappy because my presence in the house caused her not to be able to do what she needed to do. In Al-Anon, we talk about something called the three C's. You've probably heard it if you've been to meetings. We didn't cause it, we can't control it, and we can't cure it. I've come to realize after being around here for a number of years that there's a fourth C. When I tell somebody I sponsor that they don't have the power to cause them to drink or not drink, which is the power to not having the power to cause them to not drink or to drink is new information for us. We don't have that power, but we do have the power to do the fourth C, which is to co-sign it. Here's how I co-signed her drink. I would come home, she would come home from the restaurant where she worked, and I would ask her out of a legitimate concern for our relationship, our finances, her safety, the safety of others, I would ask the seemingly innocuous question, have you been drinking? Now, there's some AAs in here. You know exactly what was going through her mind. What went through her mind was, well, you nosy bastard, just for that, I'm going to drink. What just happened? We just defied that idea that I don't have the power to make her drink or not drink. I just caused her to drink, but that's not what happened. She's an alcoholic. In the cups of her disease, she drinks because alcoholism requires that she drink. By asking that innocuous question allowed her to take an action she was going to take anyway without the responsibility for the choice to do it. That's powerful stuff. She drank on me for a long time. It was my fault. She was sober at me for a long time because it was my fault. That is so powerful that if I asked her if she'd been drinking and she was already drunk, what went through her mind? Sing with me. Here's what went through her mind. Well, you nosy bastard, if you had a husband like you, you'd be drunk too. I just co-signed a drink she took 2 hours ago. I have the power to co-sign the drink. That's why we tell people when they're new in Al-Anon that you can't talk to them about it, especially when they've been drinking. Imagine talking to a 6-foot whiskey bottle in your living room. Tell me how much progress you're going to make convincing them of the error of their decision-making. It's exactly what we do, and we do it over and over and over again. So I'm going to open AA meetings with her. I have a deep respect and regard and a very big debt to Alcoholics Anonymous for what I learned in those AA meetings as a guest of AA. They said things like, I'll never forget this guy. I got up and he said, my name's Jim and I'm an alcoholic and I get to exist before you in an unnatural state. He said, my natural state is to be more or less insanely drunk because of daily maintenance of my spiritual condition, I get to exist before you in this unnatural state. And I believe absolutely that the guy that I've just described to you, who would do violence to you out of my fear, who would cheat on you if you were my wife, who would steal from you if I thought it was appropriate, is exactly who woke up across the street in my hotel room this morning with his head on my pillow. That's exactly who I am every single day. Because of daily maintenance of my spiritual condition, which began by doing something that my sponsor directed me to do against my will, and I've been doing ever since, I slid out of that bed onto my knees this morning. I said a couple of prayers. Two of them come out of the big book and another couple of them that were given to me to begin to apply the medicine to my disease, to maintain my spiritual nature so that I don't have to live like that guy one day at a time. And I believe absolutely something I heard early in Al-Anon, which was my recovery has a 24-hour shelf life. Any label readers in here? You read the medication, you read the directions on stuff. I'm a label reader. I was taking NyQuil one night. I had a cold. I can take NyQuil if I want to. And I don't get sick very often. I had this big jug of NyQuil, and I pulled it out, and I poured it in the measuring cup, which drives her crazy. Just take a pull off of that thing. I carefully measure it in the cup because I know it annoys her. And then I read the label, and the label says, it expires tomorrow. And I'll use it tonight. It's poison tomorrow. Says right on the label. Ain't touching it tomorrow. I said, it's a good thing I'm taking this tonight. It expires tomorrow. She says, well, I think you need to drink the rest of it. I believe that the meaning of that statement that my recovery has exactly a 24-hour shelf life means that I don't get any reprieve. I don't get any momentum up doing this, being of service, sponsoring people, going to meetings that allows me to coast in a gradual decline over time and then maybe have to do something. I believe what they said. If I don't do what I'm doing today, if I don't do that tomorrow, my recovery falls off a cliff. I go back to being that guy. I've never left you. I've never been a guy who said, the newcomers need a commitment. I've had plenty of commitments. Let the new guy do it. And I'm sponsoring one too many guys. And, you know, maybe somebody else should get a chance to sponsor. I've never been that guy because of another guy at those early meetings who said, I'm a visual guy, and he put his hand out beside the podium, and he says, I have right here a stack of solutions to my problem. He says, by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, the only thing in that stack was picking up a drink. Happy, sad, afraid, celebrating, not celebrating, deep loss, whatever it is, drink, 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 drink. That's when I reach over, that's what I get. He said, I came to AA, and what they gave me was some stuff to put on top of the stack. Go to meetings. Shake a few newcomers' hands. Get a commitment. Sponsor somebody. Do the steps. Have a sponsor. Make phone calls. Do service. All those things went on top of the stack. When I get a crisis in my life, I grab what's on top of it. He's been on a day that I get too busy. You know, the game's on tonight. I could probably miss a meeting. And, I'm sponsoring too many people. I take that off the top of the stack. And let's give the job to the newcomer because I've done my time. He says, there'll come a day when drinking's at the top of the stack and a crisis hits, I'm going to grab what's on top and I'm going to pick up a drink. And I keep plenty of stuff on top of that stack that would allow me to do the things I've described to you. I have always kept things on top of that stack because I know better because I believe what that man said. I was going to that meeting for about 6 months and then I snuck off to Al-Anon. I didn't want to have her or her sponsor have the satisfaction of knowing I was going. Here's what I got at home. If she was still drinking, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't have to go to Al-Anon. Drinking worked for me. I was okay with the drinking. I had the best thing I ever had in my whole life when she was drinking. I had a hope to die, nymphomaniac, blackout, alcoholic. She blacked out every night. Every morning I wake up pissed off. She thinks of something she did. She's sorry. When she's sorry, you got everything you need. You got checkbook, you got the TV clicker, that one's a hard one to give up in sobriety, that took a while. You got all the sex you want. She had a rule, she said, you are not allowed out of bed in the morning unless we have sex. Well, that's a good rule. When you're an alcoholic woman, if she could get me to sleep with her in the morning after bad behavior last night, if I'd have sex with her, I would eventually get over whatever it was, that was the rule. So that's what I sent to AA. I was good with it. You know what they sent back? A sober lesbian. Yeah. Thank you, AA. They could have helped her with the alcohol thing. There might have been a couple other things. Couldn't we have left the sex part alone? I mean, really? She says, you know, I realized after I went to AA that I've never had sex with a man when I wasn't more or less insanely drunk, and I'm not sure I even really like men. Thank you, AA. Your biggest fan. I really thought you had overreached. I sneak off to Al-Anon. We still don't like each other. I'd rather do the last year of her drinking 10 times in a row than ever do the first year of her sobriety ever again. It was nuts. First of all, she never slept. She didn't sleep for a year. She says, the people in AA say my brain is broke and I can't afford to believe anything that comes out of there. Cool. And here's what I'm thinking we should do now. Really? And then chased me through the house to share her opinions with me. We were not a vision for you. It was bad. It was really bad. So I sneak off to Al-Anon, and it turns out to be just exactly what I'm afraid it'll be. You know what it was. Went to this dingy little church in this little teeny tiny room in this little circle of chairs with 8 little blue-haired ladies and an empty chair for the newcomer boy. And I'm thinking as I'm walking in there, what probably most of you thought when you went to AA or to Al-Anon is I got nothing in common with these people. If they know anything about me, they would lock the doors before I got here. And I thought, this is the lamest thing. This is a new level of lame I've never experienced in my life. I've got nothing in common with these women. I had the great good fortune of falling in with the sickest bunch of little old ladies you have ever met in your life. They wrote their own 20 questions. My favorite was, have you ever actively plotted the death of your alcoholic? I went to my second meeting, was to become my home group. I picked it because I'm a long-distance cycle rider. I'm going to ride up there and take care of business, but I don't want anybody to know I'm new. Been going to AA for 6 months. Y'all aren't real shiny when you're new. I don't want to draw any attention to myself, so I'm going to be the anonymous newcomer secret guy in the meeting. Just me and 70 women wearing spandex. Along the vein of my solutions make my problems look good, I got a backpack on, I got my street clothes in there, I get to the meeting early, there's a little garden off the end of the meeting down there, and I'd be off in the garden, change into my street clothes, hide my bicycle in my backpack, first person's there, I'm through the door, I'm setting up the chairs, the literature, I'm happy and well adjusted, don't talk to me, they left me alone, I'm not talking to anybody. The meeting's over, I'm sweeping the floor, picking up the chairs, I'm the last one out, when they're all gone, I go change my clothes and do my ride. 2 months into that, I realized I had my first real spiritual awakening here, and I realized it was my chair to claim if I wanted. If you've ever been to Al-Anon, whether you are alcoholic or not, if you're affected by the disease of Al-Anon and alcoholism and you've been to Al-Anon, there's a chair there with your name on it, and they cannot take it from you. Not because I'm a man, not because she's sober, not because I'm somehow sicker than any of you, which I thoroughly believed, that was my chair. On that day, I left the backpack home, and I showed up wearing spandex. I walked in there in my heat shrink to fit, no secrets from the world, road cone-colored roadie bicycle suit to the anonymous newcomer guy, and my friend Patty walked up to me, and she patted me on my spandex butt, and she said, "You keep coming back." Now, I need to tell you the end of that story, because we were in that church. I went to that meeting for 25 years. We moved to a bigger room not long after that, and one time the church was having a function. They moved us back in there, and well, this is great. The place where I really made my bones in Al-Anon, and I went there and I sat down. I'm looking at all the little chairs we sat in this long, skinny room, and there's this bay window that faces out on the garden. With one-way glass on it. That's who I was. I was the naked newcomer boy in the bushes outside the meeting. I made amends to the entire group that day, which clearly they didn't feel I owed them. They were greatly entertained by my antics. I got busy around here. I had a guy sponsor very briefly who hadn't worked the steps, and I needed help. I needed to do something, and he didn't know how. And I asked a lady to be my sponsor, and I'll be forever grateful that she did not say to me, "I'm sorry, honey, I don't sponsor no men." What she said was an answer that I've been given for the last 27 years. She said, "I'd be honored to work with you." And she put me to work. She started getting me commitments. We did the work out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I made amends to that daughter. I wrote a letter to her, an earnest letter that I ran by my sponsor, and I rode up to the cemetery on my bicycle, and I sat on her grave for the first time in 17 years, and I read the letter to her to make amends. And I'm here to bear witness to the fact that you can, as it says in the literature, make amends to somebody who's not there. I did, and it worked. I also need to tell you that idea, that level of guilt and shame that I experienced, that giant weight that I carry everywhere I go, that I knew for sure you didn't have the solution to, was effectively dealt with in the process of making amends to that daughter and to that former wife. And then an event occurred there was a very great lady who's not with us anymore. The longer you're around here, the more people that are important to you you're going to lose, like we're losing them now. And it was a lady down in Texas. She died about 6 years ago. She had 62 years in Al-Anon. Her name was Arbutus O'Neill. And I heard her. She was my first ever speaker tape, and I stalked her until I found her. She came to town for a girls' conference, and they had a dinner the night before, and I crashed the party. I called Priscilla Buckley up. Priscilla's not with us anymore. And I said, "What time's dinner?" She said, "I was wondering when you were going to call." And me and the girls had dinner, and I met this woman, and we became really good friends. And every couple of months, I'd call her. And this is a lady that was there at the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. She was going to Al-Anon meetings in 1949 when they were called Not AA and the AA Wives and the AA Auxiliary. And she knew the pioneers of Alcoholics Anonymous and of Al-Anon. She knew Bill, she knew Bob, she knew Lois, and both of the Anns. She had an autographed copy of A Primer on Alcoholism written by Marty Mann, the first sober woman in New York, on her shelf when I went to her little house in Brownwood, Texas. And I would call her up and sit cross-legged at the feet of the master. She knows how the program works. She can explain it to me in terms I understand. She knows the history, which is becoming more and more important to me at that time. And then there came a day that I called her up to get mine, because it's never going to come the other way. It's never going to go that way on the phone. It's always coming this way. And I called her, and she said her son Luther had just died of a massive heart attack. And she was nearly inconsolable. And she started asking me questions that only somebody who's suffered the loss of a child knows the answer to. When she would do her talk, mostly at AA conventions, she would drift into and out of direct quotes from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you didn't know the book, you didn't know she did it. And one of the ones she frequently quoted, and I'm going to paraphrase it and probably get it wrong, was that it's in the family afterwards, in page 124 in the book, it says, "The families of the alcoholics should be only too willing to bring their secrets out of their darkest hiding places, for with it they can avert death and misery for others." They were not speaking to the alcoholic, they were talking to the families, and she brought that to life that day in that event. And what she did was she explained to me that the events that I had, the things that occurred in my life, which seemingly have zero value, that I would rather not have lived through or thought about or experienced or have in my backpack, make me uniquely qualified to somebody else, and I have done hundreds of times, to speak to somebody who suffered the loss of a child, and now that thing becomes one of my most valuable assets, as it describes in that chapter in the book. I'm gonna fast forward and just tell you a couple of quick things that have happened. One of them is that when I walked past that little girl in that crib that night to go murder those men with my car, because that was my intention, I went past the bedroom where my son lay sleeping. He was about 4 years old at the time, and he was to go out in the world by the time he was 16. We were in recovery. We'd made amends to him the best we could, and he went on the street, and he built up a series of wants and warrants in about 7 states. He wound up in Oregon, because at the time, Oregon's computers weren't talking to anybody else's computers, and they couldn't hunt him down here, and he could get a driver's license here, and he stayed here. He lives over in Bend, Oregon. And about, I don't know how many years ago it was, Harlan, 15 or 17 years ago when I came here to speak, you guys allowed me to bring him as a guest, and he was not sober. And what happened was I told Harlan that he was coming and that he was still drinking, and Harlan said, his eyes glazed over like a rat in a vampire movie. He says, "He's still drinking? Oh, he's all mine." He said, he made my son his science project for the weekend. And 4 months later, he was to get sober for the first time. He did not stay sober. He called me up, and he asked a question that, if you're a parent of an alcoholic, or even the spouse of an alcoholic, you yearn for the day when they call you and say, "I've got a problem, can you help me?" It's all I ever wanted to hear was, "I need you," or "can you help me?" It would have made me complete okay in here when I wasn't really. And on the day that he called me, I'd been with you long enough to understand the answer to the question when he said, "I'm having a problem with alcohol, can you help me?" And the answer was, "No, I cannot." Even if I were a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I am not able to help my son because he's too close to me. He can get help from anybody else on the planet who has that experience, strength, and hope, but he cannot hear it from me. And when he asked me for help, I said, "No, I can't help you. But I think I know somebody who can." I gave him Harlan's phone number. By the end of the day, he had a home group in Bend, Oregon. He had a sponsor, and he had a commitment at the conference that came up the next year. This is one of the few conferences that I've had the privilege to come back on my own dime, because I loved what I experienced when I was here as a speaker. We came back the next year, and there was a guy named Scott L. from Tennessee was speaking that night. And the third seat over at this table was my son in his shirt and his tie. And I asked him to get up and read the 12 traditions. Now, it's a policy of mine, generally, not to cry when they read the traditions. But I was sitting in the front row with my wife crying and blowing snot bubbles. I think Harlan was, too, and a few other people that were here who knew our story. And he wasn't done. He went back out after that. There was a lot of water under that bridge. And then a time came when he called me from Nebraska. He'd finally gotten a job. He'd been hardcore unemployable for a long time. He was sober 3 years, and then he went out to work on his story, I guess. And I just stayed out of it. And he called me from jail, and he said, "Dad, I finally got a job, and I can feed my kids." And I got in a bar fight last night and they put me in jail. And if I don't show up for work tomorrow, I'm going to lose my job. I was wondering if you'd consider bailing me out. And I said, this is 1:30 in the morning on Halloween. I said, I'm sorry, I can't do that. If I don't tell you anything more important than this, there is nothing more important than this. What I did not do was explain it. I did not say, because this is a consequence of your drinking, this is related to your alcoholism, I did not say because I can't afford it, I did not say because Mama would not allow me to do it, I didn't say all the reasons that went in behind the idea that I simply wasn't able to throw his bail, because my own lack of self-esteem and value causes me to be, I have an overdeveloped explaining muscle. And when I, oh, none of you, right, none of you guys got that. If I make a decision and I do the due diligence to make the decision and I give it to you, I'm still not okay unless I can convince you that it's the right one. And in the process of trying to convince you, I open a negotiation, which I'm unaware of that I do. Then we wind up in an argument, and then when I don't change my mind, the other party is clearly offended because they think they won the argument. Instead, I said, I'm sorry, I can't do that. As a result of that, he called me every day from jail for 6 weeks. And it was down on 2 felony counts. It was looking pretty bad. And the day came when he called me. He said, Dad, I know I'm in here because of my drinking. And I've looked at this little town that I'm in. It was Chadron, Nebraska, in northwest Nebraska. And there's no AA here. There were 22 Narcotics Anonymous meetings. They had one AA meeting listed in the directory with no contacts. There was no AA. He said, I want to call an alcoholic on the phone and talk to him, but they've got to be able to take a collect call from jail on a landline. Them's the rules. They can't call a cell phone, and that stuff's expensive. They nick you pretty hard. I need somebody to talk to. I called Dick Martin, another one of the giants that we lost about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. I knew Dick knew a lot of people in Nebraska. He's 800 miles away, and I said, my boy's in jail up in Nebraska, up in Chadron. He's looking for somebody to talk to, and Dick said, I'll get back to you. An hour later, the AA delegate from the state of Nebraska called me up, and he told me his name, and he said, what's going on? I said, my son's in jail. I'd like to talk to somebody. Told him it's expensive. It's got to be a landline. He said, here's my number. You can call me. I said, do you know anybody in AA up in Northwest? He says, no, but I'll look into it. The next day, two guys with big books took the first AA meeting that had ever been in that jail, took a meeting into my son. And if he's sober now and I don't ask the question, This last Halloween, he celebrated 6 years of, 6 years of sobriety in AA, not because of anything I did. It's mostly because of things I didn't do, but because I do service in Al-Anon, because I answer the phone and say yes, I'm willing to be inconvenienced to be of service and travel away from my family and stand up microphones like this. I knew people like Harlan when it was important, and I knew people like Dick, and I know other people who would do anything to help my children who I can't help. And I will close by telling you that there's a room full of people here, including myself, who would do anything to help your kids. When you can't, we will. All you gotta do is ask. Thank you.